And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the Metrospective. I'm Ted Berg, joined as always on the line by the Athletics Mets beat writer Tim Britton. Tim, baseball is a funny game because I know, for example, I know that it would require a 269-game World Series to determine statistically the better of two very good baseball teams. I know that a batter's batting average on balls in play should be about 12% higher than his line drive rate. I know that there's just so many ridiculous scientific details that we know about baseball, for sure. I know that clutch is wildly overstated and might not even exist, that there's no such thing as a hot streak, really, in baseball. And I also know that I caused the rash of injuries that has befallen the Mets over the past week.
Yeah, I mean, I think you need to be held accountable. This is a start.
No. I want to say, you need to understand, no one is taking this harder than I am.
You did it after last season saying that Dominic Smith was going to hit 74 home runs, and he didn't. And that was your fault as well.
So 0-for-2 on predictions. I didn't predict that they would all stay healthy. I'm pretty sure I predicted that exactly what would happen would happen. I said it will be like a crazy run of Mets injuries. And that night we found out that Jacob deGrom had something wrong with his shoulder. We have since learned that it is a stress reaction in his shoulder blade that will keep him out of action entirely for 4 weeks, at which point he'll be reassessed. Obviously, he will not be ready to go in 4 weeks because he'd need to be built back up. Then shortly thereafter followed the news of a hamstring tweak for Max Scherzer. Sounds like Ty Walker has a knee thing going on and had a rough outing for his last spring tune-up. It's happening. It's happening. The Mets stuff it's all coming. They had to compress it because it's a compressed spring training.
Right. What usually would have happened 2.5 weeks into spring training with an additional 3 weeks left has all happened right on the verge of opening day. And so you have as your opening day starter for a team with 5 Cy Young awards. I don't know how many All-Star game appearances all these guys have if you add them up. You have as your opening day starter Tylor McGill, who, happened to be pitching the same day as DeGrom over the course of spring training and kind of being ready for maybe a fifth starter spot if Ty Walker was not ready. But instead, he gets the opening day nod. It's a nice honor for him. Tylor is not a particularly emotive guy when we talk to him. And he was trying very hard to stay very poised and it's just another game. I'm ready to go. I told him I was ready to go. But you can see the underlying smile that he was a bit more pumped than usual when he got the news this afternoon. We're recording this on Wednesday. So he'll be the opening day starter on Thursday night now because the game was pushed back a few hours to 7:05 p.m. Scherzer is still in line to go Friday, provided that nothing happens on Thursday. But, things have happened for this team over the last couple of days. And they're also reasonably confident that Walker can make his start. That would be Monday against Philadelphia. But if he can't, then they've got some other options for that. So it's just a lot of balls juggled in the air in terms of their rotation at a time when you would really prefer it to be kind of set 1 through 5.
Yeah, and you know, it does sound like the Scherzer thing is minor. As you mentioned, he's set to pitch Friday. We hope that that's true. I don't want to say it too confidently because once bitten, you know, DeGrom is the news here, right? And it's funny, we were talking like last week, so someone who came on our live show asked about how many starts McGill would get this season. Right now, I was thinking we could throw some over-unders at each other later in the show, but if you're handicapping Mets starting pitching, like, and trying to say who's going to have the most starts this year, like, I'd say it's probably Scherzer. You'd say it's Scherzer just because he has such a good record of health. But then number two is, like, gotta be Tylor McGill at this point, right? Like, I would say that if I'm a betting man, I'm betting on McGill making certainly more starts than DeGrom and more starts than Carrasco and Walker as well.
We also have Bassett in there, a guy who's been reasonably healthy over the course of his career.
But he's been a 25 to 28 start guy, generally.
Well, that's in part, he wasn't, like, used as a full-time starter and, right, you know, got hit in the head by a line drive, right, which I think is not, you hope, not an injury that you would expect to happen again. The DeGrom news, you know, it's I think what's worrisome is, A, like, it's probably going to be 2 months, you know, until he pitches in a big league game, because, you know, if the four-week timeline goes ideally and he's able to start throwing by the end of that 4 weeks, you're at just about the end of April. DeGrom had only stretched out to 3 innings and 52 pitches in his last spring outing. So that's not like a good base to build off of. It's not like, you know, the other guys who have had this injury, Brandon McCarthy and Michael Wacha. It's a very rare injury. So it's really only those two that I've been able to find, or that anyone I think has been able to find on the beat so far. You know, Brandon McCarthy called it like a 5 week process of shutdown and build back up. But that's if it happens in the middle of the season. And you let it rest, it gets better, you build yourself back up, and then you're ready to go, and you miss five weeks or so. But it's going to take him a little longer to build back up because he's going to be basically starting from scratch again, and he's going to have to go through kind of your spring training progression. And, you know, we've seen the Mets just last year with Carrasco do that in the major leagues. You know, that they could opt to do the same thing with DeGrom. I didn't think it was a good idea with Carrasco then. I wouldn't think it's a good idea with DeGrom now. If he's like making 3 inning starts or something like that,
I'm on the other side of that, because I feel like I'm not going to actually do this, but like my extreme argument would be like, I want every single ball that Jacob DeGrom throws in 2022 to be on a major league mound in a game that counts, because like if you need to throw a 20 fastball bullpen session and at 75%, like, I still feel like that from Jacob DeGrom is better than a lot of the Mets options, just because it's DeGrom, not because the other options are so bad. And I feel like every inning you get from this guy is precious. And so, like, I don't know what, like, even if he, you know, and I guess the worry is that, you know, the adrenaline and whatever else, you know, he pushes himself too far when, you know, he shouldn't be pushing himself yet. Except that, you know, like, all the evidence suggests that doesn't really matter. Like, they've taken it slowly with him before. It seems like when the things are going to break, the things are going to break. And so I don't want Jacob DeGrom facing single A hitters, right? Even if he's working on his stuff, even if he's honing it, like, I want that in a major league game, because again, like, even if it's not the best Jacob DeGrom, it's still a guy who's going to give you like a 3.1 ERA.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, just psychologically for DeGrom, he's not going to be able to throw a 75% bullpen in a major league game.
Right, no, I understand. And obviously, I'm being hyperbolic. I don't think he should throw his bullpens in a major league game. But I do think, like, I am 100% on board with just building him up in the majors.
I mean, I think we saw, like, I wonder how things would have turned out differently last year if, you know, there were those several starts that he left early, that he would miss, you know, one start or just come back 5 days later and pitch. And, you know, it feels like all of the injuries are interrelated in some way. I don't buy that most of them were caused by him swinging the bat. I think part of it has to do with his mechanics in some way.
I have not heard that. Who made that case?
DeGrom said last year that, you know, what was four different tightnesses that he felt before the forearm tightness that eventually shut him down. And I think he ascribed three of them to swinging. essentially, that he was swinging too hard or doing this.
Well, yeah, and like maybe that's when he felt it, right? But like,
right.
Yeah, I'm with you.
So you wonder if they had taken a more conservative approach last year, if that could have nipped this in the bud in terms of the stress reaction, you know, and this is in particular an injury that like you have to wait till it heals for it to get better. So I think you've got the worry about how much time he's going to miss this season. The other thing I'd be worried about if I'm the Mets is that, you know, the two guys I mentioned earlier who've had it before, McCarthy and Waka, it recurred for both of them. For McCarthy, it was 5 times in 6 seasons where he had to deal with a stress reaction or stress fracture of his scapula. And he missed some pretty significant time at junctures there. It wasn't always 5 weeks for him. And then with Waka, he had it in 2014 and he had it again in 2016. I think he missed 2.5 months the first time and about 6 weeks the second time. And, you know, it wasn't until he strengthened his shoulder a specific way through talking with McCarthy that he was able to get over it. And so, you know, DeGrom kind of started that process last offseason. He came to spring training and said that he was working on building out the upper body muscles a little bit more than he had in the past. So maybe he's partly down that road already. But that's going to be something he's going to have to do in the offseason to make sure that this does not come back again next season or the season after that or down the line.
So let me throw a grim over-under at you. Do we see, over-under Jacob DeGrom's first start, the All-Star game?
I mean, I think he can make the All-Star team without pitching in the regular season. I think that
well, no, probably you know what I mean?
No,
I mean,
I'm joking with you. I'm not messing with you. I will say it happens before. I think because I think the most optimistic timeline here would probably have him making a start by June 1st. I think the most cynical would be that he doesn't pitch at all in 2022 or like ever again. That would be the really cynical one.
Are you really betting on the most optimistic timeline?
I'm not betting. You don't have to bet on the most optimistic timeline for him to be back before the All-Star break. If you set the over-under at June 1st or at June 15th, I'm probably taking after. But I think kind of...
When's the All-Star game this year?
The All-Star game is in LA, and it's like July 20th. It's relatively late.
Oh, it's late. Okay. What if I said July 1st?
July 1st is a lot harder. But I would say just before, but not much before.
I will say we see him in July. I'm sorry to be pessimistic. I think that's realistic. This is a uncharted territory for him. He made 12-14 starts last year. Like he's been everybody knows, every Mets fan knows, we don't have to rehash what Jacob DeGrom went through last year. It's hard to imagine the rehab process going like being a smooth return. I don't know. I don't want to be doom and gloom about it. It's getting harder and harder to fathom like that Jacob DeGrom is real, you know, it's just, I've seen him pitch. I know I've met him and spoken with him. I know he has a corporeal body. But it's something I think, I remember reading when Jose Fernandez got his Tommy John surgery, I think Rob Nyer wrote it just like, this guy was too good. And when he's referring to Fernandez's the surgery again, like not, obviously not the tragic death. But just in terms of the injury, like sometimes it's like, it seems like pitchers are just like, they fly too close to the sun. Like maybe the human body isn't supposed to be as good at pitching as Jacob DeGrom was last year. Like, is that an absurd theory?
Well, for my This Week in Mets earlier this week, I talked to Craig Goldstein from Baseball Prospectus, the editor-in-chief there, about Pecota projections, mainly about how the Mets usually underperform them. But the most interesting thing to me in all of them was, you know, they offer different like percentile outcomes for guys, you know, and it's mainly like there's the 50th percentile, basically what you'd expect from a player. And then there's, you know, you can go the 99th percentile outcome where it's the best season you can imagine from them, or the 1% outcome, which is the worst season you can imagine for them. Jacob DeGrom's 50th percentile outcome is a 1.18 ERA in a projection system, like notoriously conservative kind of thing.
Yeah. Wait, 1.18?
1.18. His 99th percentile outcome is 0.77.
His 99th percentile outcome is he doesn't allow a run all season.
Right. And the one that really blew me away was his 1% outcome. Like, the worst season their projection system could imagine for him was a 1.51 ERA.
Which, that's insane.
You know, they're projecting about 126 innings from him. But Goldstein said he's basically like broken their projection system because we just haven't seen someone you look at a player's last 3 years when you put it into a projection system mainly, look at his last 3 years in ERA. You know, he had a 1.08, I think, over 92 innings last year. Like, it's not that insane to think if and when he pitches that he could be that good. But it does feel kind of like this is the price you pay for it. It's some sort of Faustian or Dorian Gray bargain that he's got all this remarkable ability when he's on the mound, but he just hasn't been able to be on it much since last July.
Should we try to cheer things up and do some other over-unders that don't pertain to Jacob DeGrom's health?
No, I think we should talk more about Faustian bargains.
Yeah, that's why I said cheer things up, you know, once you went down that road. Dorian Gray was like, I don't know, that has some cheer to it, right? There's like there's wit to Oscar Wilde.
Oh, of course, yeah, yeah. Very witty.
Right. We haven't prepared for this at all. So how about this? I'll start because I already gave you one, but I'll give you another one just so you can start clicking around on Baseball Reference and come up with your own. Robinson Cano, games played, 99.5.
I'll take the under. I'm pretty pessimistic on Cano having a long-term role on this team for 6 months. I think it's just hard to... He's not a particularly flexible player at the moment. You know, he can play some first base, he can play some second base, he's mainly going to be a DH. I think if you are the Mets, your hope is probably that, well, I mean, maybe your number one hope is that Cano runs with the everyday DH role, but that, you know, JD Davis or Dominic Smith looks like they did in 19 or 20 respectively, and runs with that everyday designated hitter role. Where, you know, and maybe they're not the person who's DHing every day, but they're in the lineup every day and letting someone else DH. I think that's probably the Mets would like that if that happens. And if that does happen, it's just hard to find a spot for, you know, what does Cano do for you at that point? And so even if he hits relatively well, which I wouldn't know what to think. I don't know what to peg would be a reasonable expectation for him. Is it like an OPS plus of 110 or something? I don't think it's reasonable to think he'll be his 2020 self coming off of a missed season. But if he's, you know, hitting 300 with not a lot of slugging, that's still not a great designated hitter for you. And if you've got win now ambitions, you might have to cut bait. So I think that the pathway through which Cano is an active contributing member of the Mets in 2022 for 100 games is pretty narrow.
I'll take the over. You are way better informed. Like, I'm not making any pretenses to knowing anything about what I'm talking about. Other than that, like, I feel like Cano is a really good hitter. I feel like for all we talk about PEDs and steroids, like, I'm not convinced they make you a better hitter. I know that they make you... they help you stay on the field and stay healthy and keep your legs fresher, and all of those things help people perform better on all sides of the ball. I feel like for Cano being a DH will provide at least some of that, the freshness in the legs, and I think he's too good of a hitter to completely collapse, and I think he's too good of a hitter for the Mets to be able to give up on. Like, I don't think it's because of, like, it'll be some, like, grand redemption story. I think it'll just be, like, he's slightly too good to get rid of at any point and winds up playing, like, 110 to 120 games. And many of which will be, like, and I'm talking, like, 300 at-bats.
Yeah, I mean, the other part of it is that he's just not going to be a pinch hitter in as many right, games as he would otherwise in the old National League, the National League of our youth when it was real baseball, you know, even in, you know, his last full season.
But
in 2019.
He's a lefty bat and he's a contact guy. Like, I don't know. And like, I feel like it doesn't feel like a slight if like Hall of Fame caliber hitter Robinson Cano is replacing you for a hit late in the game?
Yeah, I mean, you can imagine him hitting for James McCann or maybe Mark Canna or J.D. Davis if he's in the lineup as a DH. It would be interesting, like, for instance, the Mets are likely to face, or they are facing Patrick Corbin on Thursday. Showalter said that J.D. Davis is going to be in the lineup. I didn't specify where, but I think we can presume as the DH. Maybe if Nimmo can't go, they move some pieces around. But, you know, once Corbin is out of the game and you have a predominantly right-handed Washington bullpen, but not entirely because they got Sean Doolittle back. Do the Mets then turn, you know, that first at bat against a right-handed reliever in the sixth inning for the DH spot, and it's J.D. Davis's spot, do they then turn to Robinson Cano and have him for the rest of the game in that spot? Do they kind of substitute that aggressively the way we've seen, like, the Dodgers play matchups over the last couple of years? That's an option for them. That would get him closer to your over number, but I still think, like, that's a, you know, I don't envision that being the case so often this year that it gets him to that high a number. I mean, he only played 107 in 2019, and that was as an everyday player and not having missed the previous season.
Fair enough. Give me one.
So Francisco Lindor's career OPS plus is 116. Do you think by the end of the season it will be better or worse than that?
Better. I think he's going to have a good year. I think he's a good player. I feel like, at least from what I'm reading, again, I haven't been in the room at all, but, like, at least from everything I'm reading, it sounds like he has exactly the right attitude about his bad year. He's not making excuses for it. He's owning up to it. He's saying it's going to be better. I know he's a great player. Great players tend to return to being great players. He still had a really nice year, you know, on the defensive side of the ball last year and wound up being one of the most valuable players on the team, but I think he'll hit significantly better this year. I think he'll also benefit from a much deeper lineup around him.
Yeah, I mean, his OPS for the last 4 months of the season was 822. That would be an OPS plus, let me see here, of about like 126, 127, which would be better than 116. So that's what it was over the last 4 months last year. I mean, April was the worst month of his career. May, I believe, was the third or fourth worst of his career. So you can't just throw them out wholeheartedly, but in terms of the sequence, it was nice to see him be better after that, and it was certainly nice to see him have the kind of September he did when he was at his very best in the final month of the year, when he hit, I believe, nine home runs, had an 895 OPS from September 1st on, had his three homer game against the Yankees. Felt like a lineup force in a way that he hadn't been prior to that. I think he does not have to be the focal point savior that it seemed like he was being set up to be this time last year. You know, not everyone is writing their season preview main stories and the big preview sections that come out this week about Francisco Lindor. So I think that gives him a little bit of a chance to breathe and exhale. No one's talking about the fact that his contract is kicking in this year, actually, for the first time. And like you said, he's in a better lineup. Hopefully for his sake, he's batting behind Nimmo and Marte a lot of the season with Alonso right behind him. That's a pretty nice top four for the Mets, and one that if it stays healthy, can be really productive for them.
Yeah, I think so. We're on the same page there. I think that he seems primed for a return to form, and like you said, just having guys who get on base a ton help you hit, because it's slightly easier to hit with runners on base. You're gonna see better pitches or a pitcher who's thinking a little bit about something else, and so the numbers tend to bear out that you're better off with better hitters around you. I think he'll be good. Give me one. That was yours. Last year's Mets bullpen ERA was 3.90. This year's Mets bullpen ERA over under 3.90.
Ooh, that's a good one. Because the bullpen was pretty good last year. I mean, obviously you had Loop.
Fine. I would say the bullpen was fine.
Yeah.
Right? They were fine.
And it's funny, I'm looking at their bullpen
ERAs. We're looking at the same thing, that it's like 3.45, 3.45, 3.59, 3.0. It's like all right in that range, and it's fine. That's a fine Right, 3.4 ERA from a guy in your bullpen. You're like, that's fine.
Right, and it's funny because I think if you asked me, like, descriptively to rank the seasons that various guys had there, like, I would have said that Diaz and May had better seasons than Miguel Castro, even though Castro's ERA was the same as Diaz's and was better than May's. You know, he did have a higher whip, walked more guys, that kind of thing. I think the two guys I'd feel good about are the two guys at the back end of that bullpen, in May and Diaz. May, you know, his... I understand that, like, his FIP in, you know, some of the secondary stats don't, I feel like there's now, you've got a guy's primary stats, so ERA, saves, that kind of thing. Then you've got the peripheral stats that I generally mean as, like, strikeout rate and fielding independent pitching and whip, things that are kind of indicators of success or luck or something like that. And then you've got, like, the batted ball stats that go beyond that. So that's like, you know, or things like swing and miss rate on fastballs or expected weighted on base average. And so May's primary stats and peripheral stats generally align. That tertiary, I guess, level suggests he can be better because he's been really good in terms of, you know, I looked it up. I was trying to look it up for someone else, maybe for DeGrom. And I noticed that May had like the third or fourth highest swing and miss rate on his fastball of anyone in baseball last year. And so I think there's a season in him where the ERA gets, you know, it's kind of been stuck at this 3.6, 3.8 level as a reliever where he puts up something sub three, maybe even low twos and has just kind of a dominating season where he doesn't give up as many home runs. That's kind of the thing that he does and has a really good season. You know, Diaz, similarly, I mean, his secondary stats, the FIP and strikeout rate, they would suggest even better ERAs than he posted last year at 3.45. He just kind of had the one bad stretch in July. So I think, you know, he's not going to be the 2018 version of Edwin Diaz. I think that's probably, you know, him and Lindor, like, don't expect them to be the guys they were in 2018, but they can still be really good players for you. I think the X factor in that bullpen is probably... maybe there's two of them in Lugo and Ottavino. Lugo, you know, if they use him, I'm interested in seeing how they use him because Showalter has said he doesn't really want to use him for more than three outs. But the day he said that, he used him for more than three outs in a spring game. And
it seems like that has been such a, that's been such a, like a hallmark of Lugo's value is that, right, you know, at least in the past, it was like, that was such a big part of what made Lugo great was that he could give you 6 to 9 outs sometimes.
I mean, you might say, like, yeah, in an ideal world, your starter goes 6, Lugo pitches the 7th, May the 8th, Diaz the 9th, and you win the game. But there's going to be times the starter goes 5, and Lugo can get you the 6th and 7th. Or there's going to be nights May or Diaz is not available, and Lugo can take the 7th and 8th. So I think, or there's times when other guys are successful for you and can pitch the 7th, and that frees up Lugo to be more of a jack-of-all-trades guy in your bullpen. So I think, you know, we didn't see the best of Seth Lugo last year. I think he was recovering from that offseason surgery for most of the season. And then Ottavino, I'm probably not as optimistic that he's going to get back to where he was that first season in the Bronx with the Yankees. But he was better last year with Boston than he had been in 2020. You know, I think he's a good pitcher. Probably don't lock him into a 7th or 8th inning role at the start of the year. And I'm, you know, a guy for whom the three batter rule affects on the other side of things as a right-hander, because he's been hit hard by lefties over the course of his career. But this is a really long-winded way of saying, yeah, I'll take the under on 390. Probably not by a lot, but I probably think the bullpen is a little bit better than it was last year.
I'll take the over. I think that last year's bullpen probably... I think you might not be wrong, like, that this bullpen is slightly better than last year's, but I think last year's probably pitched slightly above its head, like a, and so, like, I don't think you could have, obviously, no one was counting on Aaron Loop's sub-1 ERA, which was a factor in that 3-9. I think Familia had it wound up with a better ERA than, certainly than the peripheral suggested, like you mentioned, May, you know, was sort of prone to the home run. Mets bullpen was the 8th best in by ERA, was 8th best in baseball last year. I can't I can't see it being. I don't trust the new, like, and I don't know that they can't do it. Building a bullpen feels like such an art. And I haven't, because I haven't seen the new front office do that yet. I just don't believe that they're going to be a club that hangs with, like, the bullpens that the Dodgers and Rays turn out every year, where it's just like they always have six guys with a two ERA.
Right. And I think one of my fears with this bullpen would be the relative lack of depth in it. That, you know, last year they got pretty nice contributions from guys like Drew Smith, Sean Reed Foley. It didn't, you know, Reed Foley ended up with an ERA over five, but he was useful for a time for them. You know, Heath Hembree and Brad Hand late in the season were guys posting sub four ERAs for them. I don't know that they have that infrastructure in place right now. We're talking about them taking a nine man bullpen at the start of the year. That's going to, you know, the bullpen's going to be asked to eat more innings at the start of the season because of how condensed spring training was. It wouldn't surprise me if the usual April narrative that the hitters are behind the pitchers is not in fact the case this year, and we see some higher scoring games even in cold weather. And you're going to be, you're going to see Trevor Williams pitching two or three innings in a game in the next week probably. You're going to see, I don't know if Reed Foley will make the team or how they'll structure carrying that ninth reliever, if he's the guy or what. You're going to see a guy in that position going, pitching more than you would ideally want your ninth reliever to be pitching the first week of the season. So I wonder if those innings add up. You know, you look at what the ERA of the guys who shuttle back and forth between AAA and the majors is for a team in a given year, and it's usually like six. I think you might see more of those innings just in bulk this year.
I mean, that's like pretty much how you would define the replacement player, right? Is the guy who's shuttling back and forth between AAA and the majors.
Right, yeah.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep. You heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
I've got to come up with another one for you. How about over under 12.5? The Mets team leader in wins.
Over. Scherzer will win more than 12.5 games because he pitches so deep into games that he gets a lot of decisions, and they have a good offense. I feel like confidently over. Scherzer is going to win like 16, 17.
You know, Jacob DeGrom pitched pretty deep into games in 2018. He won 10 games.
That's true. That's fair. I don't know. I just... Max Scherzer has a winner's mentality. He pitches to the score. I don't know. It just feels like he's gonna... He's a high decisions guy in my head.
Yeah, I mean, it's... If you had given me this over-under, I would immediately complain and be like, but what are we actually getting at with it? It's not an accurate measure of anything outside of a pitcher's ability to go deep into a game and maybe his luck or fortune. You come up with a better one than I did.
Scherzer has won more than 12 games in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8... not counting 2020, in 9 of the last 10 full seasons, he's won 12 or more games. And the only season he didn't was 2019 when he missed some time and he won 11 games.
Yeah, but, you know, that was and they won the World Series. So maybe if you pick the under here, you're betting on the long game of postseason success.
I have to make one up. Pete Alonso, over under 40 home runs. 40.5. Will he hit 41? And will he go Tom Seaver? Or will he just have a mere 40? I can't think of a good sports 40.
Bartolo Colon. I think, you know, first of all, I think it's the Hunley 41 when you're talking about home runs here.
True.
I'll take the over because I feel like it was surprising to me that he ended up at 37 last year. There was a long stretch where he wasn't hitting the ball out. And, you know, like last year was a good year for Alonso. I don't think it's, you know, there's every chance that Pete Alonso's rookie season in 2019 ends up his best season and that he never hits more than the 53 home runs he hit that year. It's kind of like...
Well, but, I mean, you know, that was the year it was 2019. It's like an asterisk season, right? Like there was 700 more home runs hit than ever any other season ever, right?
Right. You know, maybe the raw numbers will not look as good, but I do think, like, you know, I don't think 2021 will be his second best season or something like that. I think there is still more in there than what he showed last year. I think especially when it comes to the power department, you never know when they're going to reduce the baseballs, by the way. And so I can see, especially in a season where we're not sure of the quality of the pitching that we'll see over 6 months in 162 games, that Alonso has kind of a more consistent power season this year than he did last year.
I buy that. I like it. I'll take the over. I think the stats instinct in me says take the under just because, 41 homers is a lot for anybody. And so you always sort of bet on people sort of falling toward the league average, I guess. But I don't know. I want to see Pete Alonso mash a bunch of dingers this year. And I believe he can hit 41.
I'll give you Starling Marte stolen bases 29.5.
What did he steal last year? It was 30-something, right?
47 last year.
47. I was going to say 37. He'll steal more than 29.5 bases this year.
Yeah, because he's averaged, he's got 296 in 10 seasons, so he's averaged just about 29.5, although he has missed, you know, he's missed time, whether it was via suspension, injury, his first year he was called up late. So that's not a wholly accurate view of what he's like over the course of a full season.
Plus now he's on the Mets. So you have to factor that in too, right? Like that you have to take the under because he's on the Mets, but I don't know, 47 steals only caught 5 times last year. Like that to me suggests a confident and exceptionally skilled base runner, and I hope they let him loose.
Yeah, like I did an exercise earlier in the offseason where so my thought going into the winter was that this was a walk year running version of Starling Marte. Because it was his walk year, he was going to run more to really pad that stolen base total. And that's what it seemed like, especially because once he got to Oakland, he ran constantly. He stole 25 bases in 56 games for them. But then I looked at the numbers and like his stolen, you know, his aggressiveness on the bases was pretty consistent with where it had been over the course of his career. Now, the only reason he hadn't stolen that much in other seasons was he just hadn't played as many games or been in situations where he didn't have as many opportunities where he's on first and no one is in front of him. And he can steal a base. So the actual rate of like attempts per stolen base opportunity was essentially consistent with where it had been in his career. So I think this is really like it's basically a bet on his health. If he's gonna play 120 games or more, he's probably gonna steal 30 bases.
I would say it's also a bet on his on base percentage, right? Because last year was his career high by a fairly significant margin in OBP, and then the other season he stole 47 bases, which is his career high, was in 2016, which was his second best year by on base percentage. So,
right.
You know, when it's having those opportunities with the base free in front of him, but it's also just, you know, being on base. Obviously.
True. And like 2019, he played most of the season, only had 25, but I think it's over. I don't think he's going to steal 40 or 50 or anything like that, but I do think he probably gets to 30 also because, you know, players control their stolen base numbers more than I think any other stat, really. And, you know, if he gets late in the season and he's sitting on 28 or something, you know, players like to get to round numbers, and he can be more aggressive to get to 30 if he wants to.
Let's do one more each, and then we'll take a question, and then we'll call it a night.
That sounds good. Yeah.
The Mets will win 91 and a half games this year.
See, that's not fair, because I was going to give you the wins.
It was my idea, the whole thing. So I got to do that one.
I'm going to go under. I think 90 and a half is what their Vegas or consensus Vegas over under is. That's what I've seen.
I think
Pecota has them currently at 90 and a half, and it was 91 before the DeGrom injury. It only dropped a half, which seemed like it should probably drop more. I have them at 88. I think that's, 88 is kind of a rough number for the Mets in their history. They've missed the playoffs with 88 wins, I think, in 97 and 98 and 07. I think 08 they won 89. With the expanded playoff format, I think 88 gets them there. I don't think they win the National League East. I think Atlanta is better, especially if DeGrom is out 2 months. That mm-hmm. changes their ability
DeGrom
to contend.
DeGrom is out 2 months, right? Like, we can't
right.
say if. Yeah.
I think 88, where they're, you know, it's a tight playoff race in the National League. I think you get, Philadelphia will be in that mix. I think San Diego and San Francisco would be in that mix. St. Louis, because I think Atlanta, Milwaukee, and LA are probably the consensus division winners in the NL. I think those other teams I mentioned all probably finish 500 or better. And so that window between 82 wins and 90 wins is where you're going to get your three wild cards. And I think the Mets end up on the right side of that with something like 88.
I think you are absolutely right. I think another thing I think the Marlins are probably a better team than a significantly better team than they were last year. They just have like such an incredible spate of young arms that it feels like they're going to be like a high 70s win team instead of a mid 60s win team. And I think, like you said, I think the Phillies are probably going to be more annoying than we expect. I think it's like, I think if you look at this from a Mets eye view, you're like, well, it's about taking down the World Series champion Braves, but Phillies finished five games ahead of the Mets last year. They made some additions. None of them seem to know how to play defense, but like, that's going to be fun. I feel like that's going to be a fun team to watch, which I hate saying, but I kind of feel like I like the Phillies this year. And yet all of this evidence saying that the division is really good, and while the Mets have gotten better, so have the teams around them. Over 91 and a half. They're going to win 108 because it's Steve Cohen and it's Billy Epler and it's a new look Mets and they're a top payroll team. And because for once in my life, I deserve it.
Okay, so I'll give you over under. Let me think of the best way to frame this. Over under a half a series win in the postseason.
They're gonna win it. They're gonna zero. I'm doing. This is strategic. Zero. They're not gonna win any postseason series.
What is strategic about that?
Well, because last week I said Jacob DeGrom was healthy. So I'm realizing it. I shouldn't have said over for 91 and a half, and I shouldn't have even teased the notion that I think they might win a postseason series. This team won't even sniff the postseason, my friend.
The 108 win, no postseason New York Mets.
The Braves are going to win 110, I don't even know if that's like mathematically possible. To miss the playoffs at 108, right? But it'll happen. If there's a way, the Mets will find it.
That is their their special ability over the years.
We have a question from someone on Twitter, Kevin, on Twitter. He says, happy opening day, Eve. He has a question for the next Metrospective episode, which you're listening to. He says, Francisco Alvarez made waves in spring training by saying his goal is to make the major league team this year. At first, I just brushed this off as a healthy amount of confidence, but the more I see Mets Twitter bemoaning James McCann, the more I wonder. What would have to happen this season for Alvarez to get the call? Do we have any sense yet of how aggressive Cohen, Epler, and the new regime will be with prospects? You would know this, and I don't, so you tell me.
We have the sense that previously they've been aggressive with their promotions of prospects in the minor leagues. You know, Alvarez played last year as a 19-year-old and was in high A pretty early in the season. He's going to be at double A as a 20-year-old this year, as a 20-year-old catcher. That's not nothing.
I'll say, but just to cut in, he was at high A as a 19-year-old, and I think was he the youngest player at the level?
It was him and one other player, I think, were the two teenagers who played regularly at high A last year.
But he was by no means overmatched. Like, I don't think you could make the case that they pushed him too far by moving him to high A. Like
Just not every team would do that because of the age strictly. Right. And so, you know, he's starting this year in Binghamton. The way he gets to the major leagues is probably a mixture of a combination of factors. It would be McCann having another difficult year offensively. It would probably involve McCann and or Tomas Nito getting hurt. It would involve probably, you know, not wanting to have Patrick Mazika and like Hayden Sanger be your catchers for an extended period of time. And you being willing to take a little bit of a defensive hit with Alvarez in order to get his bat in the lineup. Or, you know, his bat just goes off so much you're struggling to find a reliable designated hitter that he starts to fill that role for you. There's pathways to it. I don't think any particular one is that likely because, you know, if your major league catchers are hurt, you don't want to go with necessarily the bat first option in the minors. It's not like a different position where you can hide him at that position. So, you know, if McCann and Nito are hurt, the Mets would probably make a trade before they'd bring up Alvarez, even if we're talking about June or July. You know, if they really need his bat, that probably means some other things have gone wrong for them in terms of injuries or underperformance in a way that you don't want to happen. And even then, you don't necessarily want him to be used as a regular DH and lose the defensive development that he could have. So, I would not bet on Francisco Alvarez being in the major leagues this season. I did take note of, I think it was Zips projection that said like he would basically be a league average hitter as a 20-year-old. The last 20-year-old catcher to play regularly in the major leagues was Ivan Rodriguez. Ivan Rodriguez is now 50. That's how long ago it was. So it's very rare, and especially at that position.
Yeah.
And was a defensive wonderkind behind the plate.
Right. That's the point I was going to make, was there's just like I think because of the defense, they'll be not only because his defense isn't major league ready, supposedly, but because it sounds like he has a chance of being a good defensive catcher eventually. And I don't know why you'd want, like, I don't know why you'd kill that development time on behalf of a major league DH when, you know, like, on behalf of making a 20-year-old a major league DH. Like, I think you want him catching as much as you can. And it's hard for me to imagine them letting him do that down the stretch run at the major league level. But let me ask you this as a follow-up, because I hadn't thought about it. But do you think for a guy like that, for Alvarez, a 20-year-old catcher, do you think it would be easier to ascend to a major league club with an extremely veteran staff like this one? Or would it be easier to come up with a bunch of other rookies and guys you might have some familiarity with from coming through the minors?
I think it would be easier with the younger pitchers in the sense that it would be less awkward. They would make fewer demands of you.
Mm-hmm.
But it, in terms of for the team as a whole, they can a veteran staff can probably hide you better as an inexperienced catcher because, you know, Max Scherzer knows what pitch he wants to throw next,
right,
basically. In a way that younger pitchers don't. You know, I remember talking to Zach Wheeler in 2018 or 2019, and he was running through kind of when he learned to read swings as a pitcher, and it's much later than when a catcher learns to read swings.
Right.
So that's the value of having a a smart, observant catcher behind the plate who knows what's how hitters are reacting to your stuff even better than you do from the mound. So I think with a young staff, that would be a hole for them. Having a veteran staff that pretty much knows what it's doing on the mound, they could maybe get away with it. You know, if Alvarez is hitting 360 in the minor leagues and it's August and the Mets and JD Davis is hurt and the Mets need a right-handed platoon DH and they're right in the thick of things in the NL, yeah, like that might be the option. You know, if he's doing better than Mark Vientos, better than anyone else that you could have in the minor leagues or something like that, then maybe you think about Alvarez. But again, I don't think it's likely, but I do think it's plausible.
Yeah, and you mentioned Vientos. Like, he was just – he's another real, real young guy who had a lot of success at high levels last year. It just seems like his bat is going to be a step ahead of Alvarez's. And so, like you said, like, why go with the bigger prospect and the premium position guy if you're just looking for that righty power bat?
Yeah, so it is at least nice for a Mets fan that you can start to think about what these prospects can do for you in the major leagues this season or early next season. You know, it's been so long that we've talked about this next wave of prospects, you know, since really Alonso and McNeil made their debuts. There hasn't been someone to really dream on, and even those two guys, you know, McNeil kind of came out of nowhere that season in 2018, and Alonso, you know, was not a top 100 prospect at the start of the 2018 season. Right. So it's been a while since you could really think about, like, waiting on debuts at the major league level from highly touted guys.
The pitchers, it was the pitchers, right? It wasn't the position players. Like, the last big run of prospects I can think of is obviously, like, the 2015 starting staff, basically. Syndergaard, well, Harvey, DeGrom. And DeGrom came up with no fanfare whatsoever, but Syndergaard, Mats, and Harvey all did.
Well, DeGrom came up with the fanfare of Rafael Montero pitching right around him. You know, you had Amed Rosario and Dom Smith late in 2017. That was probably the last time you had, Alonso for opening day 2019. There was buzz by that point, but it hadn't been built over years the way it has with this next group, this next core group of Mets prospects.
Right. Alonso had a big spring, and then remember, it was big news that they didn't force him to sit out for 20 games or whatever, like that they brought him north. That certainly helped generate some of the hype around Alonso, which then he immediately matched and bettered even. So that would be cool too if the next run of prospects can do that.
Yeah, the way that McNeil and Alonso both turning into all-stars in 2019, if the Mets have two guys in the 2023 all-star game who have yet to make their major league debuts, they would be really, really happy.
That is a great place to end with a little bit of optimism. Thank you for listening. We will be back with another live show soon. And at that point, ideally, weather permitting, there will be real baseball games to recap and discuss.
At least one. So, you know, that's the aim at
real,
this point in the
possibly
week.
Possibly, weather permitting, a baseball game. And man, will we talk about it.
Ready to break down every aspect of opening day.
Till then, Tim, peace out.
Adios.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code The Athletic and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.